proposal at Affordable Housing Partnership and just come and tap in.
Thank you so much, Christina.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful.
You are listening to WGXC ICRA, hands-on creative community radio at 90.7 FM and streaming live online at WGXC.org. WGXC is a program division of Wave Farm.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Inga Iverson of Philmont, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Tune in WGXC's new Sunday morning schedule with the Reverend Kim Singletary and There's a Bright Side Somewhere every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. That's followed by the teens from Hudson talking about books they've read on Bound by Books after the local news at 9 a.m. And at 10 a.m., there's more teens. The Catskill kids from Clubhouse Radio are on at 10 a.m. with lots of music and talk on your community radio station, WGXC.org, 90.7 FM. You're listening to Wireless Reconnaissance Broadcast Surveillance Transmission.
Hello. Welcome to Movies on the Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, ICRA, Catskill, Hudson. You're tuned in to live, synchronized sounds from the Philmont Media Project's outdoor sidewalk cinema located at the Purpose Makerspace, 100 Main Street in the beautiful village of Philmont, New York. On the radio, we showcase the sounds of experimental cinema and experiments in sound from artists, filmmakers, and makers of all stripes in Columbia and Greene counties and across the world. This evening, we'll be speaking with John Isaacs, the Claverick-based designer, editor of imbi.com, and filmmaker. Right now, we're warming up the sidewalk cinema screen to project John's wonderful documentary short, The Art of Lotte Reiniger. We'll be listening in on his film and on our conversation with John Isaacs in just a moment. But first, who is Lotte Reiniger? Well, to begin with, she's an incredibly important, if little known, figure in the history of the cinema and of animation. Reiniger is probably best known for her 1926 film, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, which is widely regarded to be the first feature-length animated film. It's also exemplary of the shadow or silhouette puppet style of stop-motion animation that Reiniger really invented and would continue to refine throughout her life. Reiniger began experimenting with silhouette animations in Germany in the 19-teens and 20s, and she was a part of the general flourishing of German cinema that was happening during this Weimar period, which film historians and scholars note for the emergence of the cinematic style known as German Expressionism, which really emphasized the interplay of shadow and light to explore the fantastic and the strange. If you're familiar with Robert Vine's The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or maybe Fritz Lang's Metropolis, then you'll know the aesthetic I'm talking about. But even as a contemporary of these filmmakers, Lotta Reiniger's work really stands out for its technical and formal inventiveness. Reiniger really synthesized her immense skill in the German papercraft form of Scherenschnitte, which is essentially the art of creating figures from paper cutouts, with an interest in the shadow theater traditions of the Far East, places like China, Bali, Java, a sort of proto-cinema where puppets were used to cast shadows onto a screen. Reiniger brought together these ancient theatrical and folk craft traditions to combine them with the really still new and emerging technology and art of the cinema to create something that no one had ever seen before. And you, dear listener, have a chance to see some of that work now at the Filmont Media Projects. Sidewalk Cinema at 100 Main Street in Philmont, New York, where for the next hour we will be screening John Isaacs, created in the Philmont Media Projects Animation Lab, where we've been using some of the techniques developed by Lotta Reiniger to make our own shadow animations. It's WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson. My name is Heath. And it's time for Movies on the Radio. John, welcome.
Thank you.
So we're talking today because you have worked with Lotta Reiniger, a name that is probably less familiar than it should be, but Lotta was a pioneering filmmaker and artist and most notably animator in the early 20th, throughout the 20th century. And you had the very good fortune to know her and to work with her and then produce a short documentary film about her. And I was hoping to have a conversation with you to learn more about your experiences with this wonderful and important filmmaker. Could you tell us, how did you first come into Lottie's orbit?
Oh, I had somebody I fell in love with when I was 20, 21 years old, was a young and complicated woman in London. It was while I was a student of philosophy at University College London.
We share that. I was also an undergraduate philosophy student.
There we go. And, you know, I came into her social circle and became particularly close to her family, which was kind of an unusual family in those days in North London. Her father was a war hero, a Jewish man who had emigrated to Britain during the 30s. And he eventually became a pilot who wrote a very celebrated book called Arnhem Lift, which described one of the most horrific periods of the late Second World War hostilities. And he was a strange and wonderful man. And after the war, having settled in London, he reconnected with Lotta, who had also moved to London.
My understanding of that timeline was that she left, she and her husband, Karl Koch, left Germany in the mid-30s, like so many filmmakers and artists and intellectuals did.
Well, there's an interesting thing. Lotta was never very clear about where she had spent the war years. And nobody quite knows why or whether or how she eventually came to London, which was post-war in something like 1946. She was always very reluctant to talk about the war years, which I suspect she had actually spent in Berlin.
So I've done a little, there's a great monograph about Lotta by Whitney Grace. And as near as I can tell, she left Germany in the 30s and couldn't get a visa anywhere else and spent time, you know, in various European countries, making connections with people like Jean Renoir in France and other filmmakers. But yeah, she couldn't find a place to live, couldn't get a visa anywhere, bounced around Europe, and by the before the war even ended, wound up back in Berlin.
Exactly. That's generally accepted. You know, the Jean Renoir connection was very clear that Carl, her husband, had worked as assistant director on many of Jean Renoir's great films prior to the war. But we tend to think that she had spent the war years in Berlin. Mm-hmm. But nobody knows what they were doing. But it is absolutely clear that she moved to Britain post-war in the late 40s. And that was when the person to whom I'm referring, the father of my girlfriend, reconnected with her. And his name was Louis Hagen, who had this kind of remarkable career during the war. And his reason for reconnecting with Lotta was that his father, who had been an extremely affluent and prominent Jewish banker in Berlin in the 20s and 30s, had originally financed Lotta's magnum opus, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed. Mm-hmm. And the circumstances under which he did so are also kind of curious. He, as a banker, had sunk a ton of funds into buying unprocessed 35mm film stock.
I've heard about this from other sort of Weimar era German filmmaking. There's even a sort of a theory that the inflation that was happening in Germany spurred a lot of the creative work because the film stock held its value better than a pile of cash, right? So you just buy a ton of it and use it. Because it was a good investment, right? Is that the case of Lotta too? And
correct, absolutely. Okay. You're absolutely right. That's a good detail. So that was the backstory to the Louis Hagen Senior's financing of The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, and that's the backstory to Louis Hagen Junior's reconnection with her after the war in London, where they were both living.
Okay.
So as a result of that reconnection, Louis Hagen Jr. formed a film production company whose pretty much, so they did a few other things, but basically what they did was finance and produce a whole new series of Lotta's silhouette films, which were highly successful, shown on the BBC every week and distributed throughout the world. And they made a business out of that, and Lotta had an ongoing career, though her stature as a great filmmaker was by no means established at that point, mm-hmm. you know, despite her, you know, fabulous contribution with Prince Ahmed. So they worked together for, I don't know, maybe 10, 12, maybe even 15 years, producing films which were widely distributed across television. And these were kind of early days of television. And I, indeed, as a kid growing up in Britain, remember them, you know, as weekly events on British television, on the BBC. Remember them vividly. I can't say I was particularly engaged by them. They were lovely little fairy tales and everything, but very quaint, but they weren't high on my mm-hmm. cultural radar as a kid watching. Anyway, so then I had this relationship with Louis Hagen's daughter. I'm going to call Louis Boody from now on.
Okay.
Boody was his nickname. It's short for Brüderlein, which is little brother, because he was the littlest brother of six or seven children or whatever in their home in Potsdam near Berlin. And when I established this connection with them in, I guess, 1968, probably, or 1969, Boody hadn't had any connection with Lotte for a considerable number of years, 10, 12, 15, I don't know, mid-50s or so. And they had fallen out over some, you know, legal, financial arrangement, and which was kind of sad, and Boody was in the meantime writing some rather successful books about Nazi Germany, because he had such direct experience of it and so on. And when I came on the scene, he was just wrapping up a book called Secret War for Europe, which was a fascinating document and a kind of a bestseller. And he was kind of at a loose end. And I said, why don't you reconnect with Lotte? And let's make a film about her.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a nice document to do. And I had no filmmaking experience whatsoever. I was studying philosophy at University College. But we decided to do it, and Boody funded it. It wasn't very expensive to make, as you can see. And we contacted Lotte, and she was kind of delighted. And we went up to see her at her studio in Barnet, which is one of the northernmost suburbs of London. And she was living in kind of really rather grim circumstances. She certainly had no income. She was being, her lodging was in a kind of art center that had been set up by a woman from Eastern Germany, a kind of supporter of the arts. And Lotte was living in a very constricted apartment, cluttered. We went up to see her, cluttered with all the figures from her productions and so on, all on the walls and everywhere. And there she was, you know, overweight and chain smoking, and had a lot of reminiscences, and was kind of pleased to see Boody, and I was new on the scene completely. Mm-hmm. And she warmed to the idea of doing a documentary about herself, about her career and so on. And she had there in her studio the original animation table that she had used for Prince Ahmed and all the subsequent fairy tale films.
And now this is what she called her Tricktisch, if I'm right, in the German for Tricktisch.
That's actually a technical term It's a technical term in German. It just means animation table.
Basically. Yeah. Can we linger for a moment on that? Can we kind of describe this thing physically? Because she's one of the pioneers, if not inventors, of this particular animation technique. And it's really fascinating. And at the moment, we're doing some workshops, and we'll be doing workshops in the media project, inspired by and using some of her techniques for creating shadow silhouette animations. And for listeners especially, maybe you could kind of walk through how her setup looked and functioned, and exactly, you know, how it was she created these really stunning silhouette animations.
Well, it was completely original. Nobody had done anything remotely like this before. She originated the technique in 1917, mm-hmm. and developed it in the course of a few years, and, you know, developed it to its apogee with The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, which was effectively the first full-length animated feature in mm-hmm. the cinema before Disney. And the technique differs very much from Disney, which is really, Disney technique is a succession of drawings that are just overlaid and photographed and formed into a continuous animated sequence. Mm-hmm. But she was using puppets, which rather in the mode of Javanese puppet theater, mm-hmm. were silhouettes against a backlit background, which with the advantage of a camera could be upped and lowered to produce zooms and manipulated across the screen to produce pans. Mm-hmm. So she used these various, you know, the zooming and the panning techniques in a way that was very novel. If you look at silent films like Chaplin and so on from those days, there's very little zooming, very little panning. She really invented that. She mm-hmm. was the inventor of panning and zooming, which was in itself remarkable. But what was most remarkable was her ability to not only produce the figures, the characters, which were flat silhouette cutouts with little hinges between their moving limbs, to do that and produce this exquisite movement and sensitivity within the animation process, but also to align it completely with music, mm-hmm. that the whole thing, so there were all these parameters going on, the zoom, the pan, the manipulation of the figures, the alignment with the movement, and numerous special effects that she added also. All these were functionalities that were completely and totally novel to cinema. Nothing had ever been done like them before. Just setting up a camera in front of Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton, great, you know, they were great performers, but the actual techniques of cinema that are used so widely today were really pioneered by her in her animation technique. And that's what makes her so extraordinary.
Yeah.
Nobody had done that before. Nobody. So that we tried to illustrate in our little documentary. And as I said, I'd never made a film before, and it's extremely crude. But we went on to make a whole succession of other documentaries, which happened not to be available on YouTube, but were much more, you know, in depth about her technique and about her contribution to cinema technique and so on. And we did that over the period of a couple of years. And in the midst of that, Budi and I decided to track down the origins of The Adventures of Prince Ahmed. And there existed a kind of rather saccharine version of the whole thing, which was only a black and white print and had kind of horrible music and nasty subtitles. And that had been distributed for quite a number of years, but had never gone anywhere. And we did some in-depth research and ultimately discovered that there was a very, very fragile nitrate print in color of the original Prince Achmed in the archives of the National Film Board in London, which was an extraordinary discovery. We found it in a bunch of 35 millimeter film cans in their archives, stocked right away. And we couldn't believe our eyes that here was The Adventures of Prince Achmed, the world's first full-length animated film in its original condition. And we took that to Technicolor in London, Technicolor's offices in London, because the process of retrieving, getting a copy of that original nitrate print was not a photographic process, it was a printing process. I don't know if you know, but Technicolor is a printing process, not a photographic process. So we were able, with Technicolor's assistance, to reproduce the original visual of The Adventures of Prince Achmed perfectly.
And can you say a little bit more about the color? Because some of our listeners might be, you know, stopping and scratching their heads and saying, "No, now wait a second. This is a film from the 20s. How is it a color film?"
We don't know.
She was dyeing the films, right?
We don't know. It was dyed in some way, and we don't know how she managed that that process. But that's how it was originally presented in color. We have no idea who did it, where it was done, or anything.
But it's really beautiful, because in the Prince Achmed film, you know, you have these night scenes that are these vivid, you know, deep hues of blue, and then you'll switch to, you know, a scene in the desert or a jungle, and you get these intense yellows, or the expressive, as you know, as you've already talked about, some of the expressive things she's able to achieve with relatively rudimentary and still kind of primitive cinematic tools is really, really just astounding. And the color is another one of those things. The dyes and the atmosphere she was able to create with them is really just amazing. And I'm hoping people, you know, people who are able to see your film out here on Main Street will be able to see some of that really, really wonderful color work as well.
Well, confession, I prefer the black and white.
Really, really.
But anyway, you know, it was a remarkable thing to restore how it was originally shown in Berlin. So we then arranged with the National Film Theatre in London to show this, along with my little modest documentary, and with Lotte demonstrating. We brought the Triktisch, the animation table, to the National Film Theatre in London, and she was up on the stage doing her shtick, showing how she produced these remarkable animations. And it was before a huge audience. The National Film Theatre holds, you know, several thousand people. And suddenly she was, from her terrible diminished circumstances in her studio in Barnet, she was suddenly a star, and she got rave reviews in the Sunday Times and the Guardian and the Daily Telegraph and everything else. And her career was, you know, was resurrected in terms of reputation.
So this show was this the early 70s then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. I probably 1970 or 71.
Okay. Can't remember
exactly. And from then on, we started, you know, given that her relationship with Beauty Hagen had been restored, we were then able to start promoting her worldwide. And we had Prince Ahmed shown at a whole succession of film festivals, including Berlin, which I think was 1971, where she was awarded the Golden Lion, which was a huge honor. And then she went on to win numerous awards, and her career was completely revitalized. And she was invited by the National Film Board of Canada to go there, and they financed new movies that for her. And she was back into movie making. And those movies weren't so great. She was experimenting with color, which was not nearly as effective as the black and white silhouette films. But that's when her reputation was reestablished, and she was considered, and rightfully considered, one of the great pioneers of cinema. I have several mementos from my friendship with her. This is the one I treasure most.
Can you hold it up just more? I think I'm missing maybe the bottom of... there's a whole... It's vertical.
I just want to show you here.
Are those cutouts or is that a little...
My fingers. Those are cutouts.
Okay.
Right?
Beautiful. So we're seeing, it looks like a series of ballerinas or dancers in some really dynamic, fluid poses. Exactly.
Now, she cut those out for me, I would say, in 2 minutes maximum.
Wow. I think in your documentary, she's working, maybe it's on the Papageno films. Yeah. And she cuts out a number of figures, and they look as if they're maybe, you know, a foot and a half tall.
They tended to be. That was about their size.
And she's just cutting out, you know, intricate patterns in their clothing, you know, replicating lace or feathers. Exactly. You know, it's not a rudimentary process. Her ability to do that was really astounding. And then when you see her...
She cut these out for me when she was, you know, in her mid-70s, wow. late 70s. And they're tiny. And this is the original, by the way, not a reproduction. These are the original cutouts. So you see... That was, first of all, one of her remarkable skills, the ability to cut out figures with scissors. She'd be like this, little scissors. But the next most remarkable thing was her ability to create these figures in such a way that they could move. And that involved... introducing axles in their limbs. So that was also what was remarkable, that she could create figures that were like Javanese puppet theaters. You've got something there? Exactly.
Yeah, so this is a figure. Now, we're working with some on a smaller scale here,
correct.
Because I just have a little light box.
They
but
look just like
by a lot of, we are making
exactly.
these... figures here, and they have, you know, the articulated
exactly.
limbs and joints. And watching Lada's she had a sort of preternatural sense for movement too. When you see her working on these films, the way she's able to capture with really a lot of verisimilitude the way people move and dance and fall and the weight of bodies is something that's always impressed me. But then when I see her at work in your film, the ease with which she seems to know exactly how to, you know, duplicate a human gait or a leap or a dance. She seemed to be able to see it in her head in advance and just, you know, do it. She was making these successions of images so quickly. It's really remarkable.
You said it, Heath. It was truly extraordinary. The third thing was how she was able to integrate what you've been describing with music.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a great lover of music, of of classical music, particularly Mozart. And the way that the figures are moved to synchronize with the rhythm of a particular piece, be it the magic flute or whatever, was completely remarkable. And so that would, that, you know, that's the, those would be my observations of her. I have to say unique, and they really are unique. You know, Disney may have got the music right, and you know, somebody else might have got the movement right, but to bring all these things together as a concept of cinema was really, really remarkable.
Yeah, and it really is a sort of eat your heart out, Disney, because I mean, the Adventures of Prince Ahmed is what, 10, 11 years before Disney started?
Four or five years.
Still, she got there first.
But they're very different art forms.
Mm-hmm.
Can I talk a little about Lotta as a character?
Please do. Yes, I would. Stories I would love to hear. Yeah.
Well, you know, I met her, as you gather, on numerous occasions, and I kept up my friendship with her as long as I was living in Britain, which was until 1980. And I think she died in 82, 83, early 80s anyway. And I think she died very happy, by the way. For her to have been elevated at that stage of her life into the, you know, the great, what do we call it? Her legacy was acknowledged finally. A really wonderful thing for her. And there are museums in Germany now that have whole collections of her work and her puppetry and everything else. She's fabulous. But what I remember most vividly about her from the many days and evenings I spent with her, she was a lovely woman. Wasn't easy. She was very opinionated and, but charming in her many, many ways. But what I remember most vividly about her was her attachment to the characters in her films, even though they were only cardboard.
Mm-hmm.
That she didn't have children of her own. And she treated these characters, she would kind of pull them off the wall. We'd have been having dinner in her flat and in her apartment, and she'd take them off the wall and she'd stroke them as though they were children or at least pets.
Mm-hmm.
She had a really alive relationship with the puppets.
That makes me love her even more.
And totally unique, but she really, really did. She believed her belief in these characters as real was so profound and it clarified her ability to work with these creatures and make them come alive.
You can see it. You can really see it in the films that these figures, she somehow managed to imbue a little bit of her soul into these pieces of cardboard. And it's really, they become human, you know, under her direction. It's really,
absolutely.
Really cool.
And with such generous spirit and mm-hmm. such sympathy and kind of, you know, sense of the mythology, you know, human mythology and everything. She was really a very, very remarkable woman.
Is there any place? So you mentioned there are you have other documentary shorts. Are they shorts?
I don't know where they are.
Okay.
Well, they were commissioned by the Goethe Institute, which is the German cultural institute, and there were several we made subsequently. I don't know that, you know, they're better made cinematically because I was getting some experience as a filmmaker, but I don't know that they're any better according to, you know, the information they basically provide or the charm that they had. I think the first documentary, crude though it was, conveys her character. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds like maybe another research project for me is to try to track down some of your other films.
Yeah, I've been able to. I mean, I don't think they're online. Probably from the Goethe Institute will have them. And maybe even the Museum of Modern Art, which their archives. Well,
so. If people wanted to see your documentary that is available online, where could they find that?
It's on YouTube. The Art of Lotte Reiniger.
The Art of Lotte Reiniger on YouTube. John Isaacs, thank you so much for taking this time to share your memories of Lotte Reiniger.
My pleasure. And I hope, you know, whoever gets to look at her films, and in particular, The Adventures of Prince Achmed, revel in it. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Of Prince Achmed was the first full-length animated film in the history of the cinema. It was made by Lotte Reiniger between 1923 and 26 in Potsdam, Germany. For the past 20 years or so, she's been working in her studios in Barnet. Here, she has produced one after another her unique silhouette films, the technique of which she was the pioneer. Since Miss Reiniger made Prince Achmed, she has made over 40 films, all using simple variations of the basic technique. And simple though this technique might seem, it is in the subtleties of its application that its success is achieved.
Here I am to tell you about what I shall have to do to make a silhouette film. First of all, select an idea which I like to do very much, for the work takes a very long time. Let us make Papageno.
The chosen character, Papageno, has first to be fitted into the story, and for this, various sets of figures are designed. These eventually complete the final storyboard, the blueprint for the film, showing the different sequences which will later be further broken down into the particular movements of the figures.
Despite the intricate nature of her specialized technique of filming, the importance of the story must not be underestimated in Miss Reiniger's work. The magic of the fairy tale has always been her greatest fascination. Yet, her own interpretations attain a unique quality.
Once it is decided how Papageno will look, Miss Reiniger can begin to cut out the figure. First his head with its feathery headdress, for Papageno is a bird catcher and must look like a bird in order to carry out his profession.
The original film of Papageno, taken from the sequence in Mozart's opera she made in 1935, the figures she cuts out and constructs were originally inspired by the puppets used in traditional Eastern shadow theaters, of which the silhouette film is the logical conclusion. And nowadays, much of her time is devoted to staging shadow theater plays. Yet it is remarkable how little the technique has changed. The material, the black cardboard, the scissors, remain the same as for our earliest films, the first of which she made in 1917.
And then the whole figure and his costume are cut out in individual sections.
The number of separate pieces does, of course, depend on the amount of movement that is required of the figure. Papageno, being a particularly important character, is particularly complex construction. First, small holes are pierced in relevant points. All these limbs and pieces of costume are joined together with small wire hinges. The hinges are intricately tied, for it is essential that they successfully withstand the constant movement demanded of them. When such a hinge is subject to excessive use, it is weighted with flat pieces of lead, which helps also, of course, to keep the figure flat, for otherwise it might warp under the heat of the camera lights. And then the whole figure is rolled out flat. Despite the speed of their construction, Ms. Reiniger will continue to have a strange effect for each of her figures, an understandable affection, for in their flexibility they have almost human characteristics of movement. His movements are checked, standing, sitting, kneeling, hopping, and so on. Now he can be filmed, and for this he must be placed on the animation table.
This is a trick table. If you don't have such a thing at home, you take your best dining table, cut a hole into it, put a glass plate over it, and over the glass plate some transparent paper, and then you put some light on from underneath, and then you switch the other light in the room out, then you see this joy that your figure now is a real figure.
To make the figure move, it must be placed in the correct position and a shot taken. The figure is then moved a fraction further and a second shot is taken, and so on, so that with much patience and concentration, the figure moves more and more. The camera shutter opens again and again, and the final result will be the figure moving across the screen. There is, of course, a great deal more to it than this. For example, among the specialized techniques which may have to be employed is the possibility of the figure turning. Moving, as seen before, it is first necessary to mark its position. The next step is to turn its head, take a picture, and then gradually the limbs turned one by one and pictures taken. You can now proceed to move in the opposite direction. Alternatively, one can cheat a little by turning the figure as another figure passes in front of him. Because the camera is fixed, and besides, to go too near to small figures would make their outline appear too rough, to achieve close-ups it is necessary to construct an entirely new version of the original figure. In this way, the expression of the figure may be altered in close-up. As this is a profile art, the action is composed so that the effects of distance or depth are avoided to maintain a purity of style. But these magical figures must sometimes come into the picture from nowhere. For this effect, the shape of the figure must be repeated in numerous different sizes, all numbered. Starting with nothing, the smallest of the figures is placed on the set, a shot taken, and the next in the series put in its place. Gradually, the figure will reach its destination and appear full size on the screen. This effect can be used for all kinds of transformations and appearances,
One of the most important tools of the technique are the scissors, and it is in the construction of the backgrounds that the scissors play one of their most vital roles, constructing the different layers and thicknesses of transparent paper. Over all these layers is placed a single sheet of paper to give the figure freedom to move. And for the clouds and water, a second glass plate is used so that these can appear slightly out of focus. Bearing in mind that the camera is fixed, it must be emphasized that in order to create panning effects, it is necessary to move the whole set. Each movement is charted on a rule so that the movement of the set is coordinated with that of the figure. During the shooting, each frame is numbered and recorded in the shooting book, so that the number of shots corresponds to the music and the movements. Four, if the action is fitted to the music like a ballet, with the sound recorded beforehand, then from the score at particular number of shots and calls to the length of each bar. This carefully calculated shooting of the film may proceed so that this delicate balance of musical notes, the individual movements of the figures and of camera shots will produce the harmony which characterizes the films of Lotte Reinecke.
Vogelfänger bin ich, ja, ich heiße Hopp, Hopp, ich Vogelfänger bin bekannt bei alt und jung im ganzen Land. Weit mit dem Locken umzugehen und mich auf Weiden zu verstehen. Guten Tag, mich froh und lustig sein, denn alle Vögel sind ja mein.
Miss Reinecke worked almost from the outset with her husband Karl Koch, who died in 1963. He had been a prominent filmmaker in his own right, working with Jean Renoir on the first World War classic, La Grande Illusion, and completing Tosca for him in Italy. More recently, he and Miss Reinecke developed the silhouette technique to include color. The construction of colored figures is much the same as that of silhouette, but they are dressed up with colored paper above, the hinges hidden beneath. Various parts of the set are also constructed in this way, but mostly the backgrounds are made up of colored cinnabar, allowing an infinite number of colors and combinations to be achieved. The cinnabar background is covered by a layer of frost, matte colorless cinnabar, which saves the figures being caught in the background and also give a unison to the otherwise rather sharp outlines. With the use of top lighting, the color of the figures is highlighted. Lit from below, the effect is that of silhouette with colored backgrounds, an effect used in several Reinecke films. This set is from interlude in the Coventry Theatre pantomime The Frog Prince and shows the well into which the frog has jumped in order to retrieve the princess's golden ball.
Well, there we have it, folks. The Art of Lotte Reiniger, directed by John Isaacs. I really hope you enjoyed listening in and our conversation with John as well. It was wonderful to have the chance to hear about his recollections of Lotte's life and work. Well, that's it until next time for Movies on the Radio. You can check us out the second Thursday of every month live on WGXC 90.7 FM. Or visit wavefarm.org to find an archived recording of all of our shows, which can also be found at the Philmont Media Project's website, philmontmediaproject.org/moviesontheradio. If you are a film or moving image maker in Columbia and Greene counties and have work that you would like to share with Movies on the Radio, you can contact us at the Philmont Media Project, that's Philmont with an F, at gmail.com. This broadcast is made possible in part with funds from the Decentralization Program, a re-grant program of the New York State Council on the Arts with the support of Governor Andrew M. Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, administered in Columbia County by the Greene County Council on the Arts. Movies on the Radio and the Sidewalk Cinema are produced by the Philmont Media Project. The Philmont Media Project is a proud member of the Purpose Co-working Cooperative in Philmont, New York.
Was it the movie or the making of Fitzcarraldo? Was someone learned to love again? I can't remember, it's not the same as I don't know. Virgin with a memory. Was it the movie or the making of Fitzcarraldo? Where your mother decided to fashion herself after the sanctity we left on the shelf. She wanted blood, how she got was sacrificed. She wanted blood, how she